This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello, folks. This is Ben, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers, in which I have conversations with photographers. It's a photography podcast. You should know that already. I'm sure you already do. Thank you for joining me. It's nice to have you along this week. I'm very excited to say that my guest is the fantastic Tom Wood. I will introduce Tom properly in a minute. Let's do a little bit of housekeeping first, because it's important that I say a couple of things. One is, if you've been considering signing up as a member of this podcast to support the show and to gain exclusive access to special additional bonus content that you cannot otherwise listen to, then please go to pod.fan and sign up for £5 a month. That's like two cups of coffee. Not even two, really, is it? Two cups of coffee a month to sign up for the special subscriber-only edition of this podcast, which goes out on the alternate weeks when the main one doesn't go out. And as I say, you're going to get, well, you're going to get the previous week's guest answering 20 bonus questions, including Tom Wood himself, of course, catch-ups and check-ins with former guests, all the occasional specials from festivals and that kind of thing, openings. That's going to be starting to happen again quite soon, hopefully. So you can basically show your support and help fund the ongoing production of this podcast by joining up as a member, or you can sign up as a supporter for just £3 a month, but you won't get the special bonus content, so you may as well really go the whole hog. Be nice if you could go ahead and do that. If you do happen to need a new website, I can build you one using Squarespace. Yeah, that's about all to say about that. Please leave me a positive review on iTunes so that other people will find out about the podcast. And this episode is brought to you, as usual, by the excellent Charcoal Book Club, the monthly subscription service for photo book enthusiasts that brings essential limited edition and hard-to-find photo books to your doorstep. Working with the most respected names in contemporary photography, Charcoal Book Club selects and delivers essential photo books to a world... I always say that, photo box. Essential photo books to a worldwide community of collectors, whether they be long-time enthusiasts with a stock library or novices just beginning to build their collection. Join up as a member, and each month you will receive a new museum-quality first edition monograph to add to your shelves, handpicked by Charcoal's team of expert curators and signed by the artist, along with a signed note card and exclusive print. Sometimes the book of the month will be a classic title every bibliophile should own. Sometimes it will be a new release from an emerging artist who is poised to make big waves. They offer free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US. And members also get exclusive perks such as signed copies, access to rare titles, members-only pricing in Charcoal's online bookstore and more. All of which makes the Charcoal Book Club the best, easiest and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. Been a couple of interesting titles lately. I got Rauber by Josh Kern came through a couple of weeks ago. The most recent one, this month's book of the month, Black Diamonds by Rich Joseph Facon. I think that's probably how you pronounce it. I hope that's right. Both really interesting titles. I Can't Stand to See You Cry by Raheem Fortune was the one before that. I don't know if I've mentioned that one already. I think I intended to if I hadn't. So those are some of the great titles that have been books of the month recently. Go to charcoalbookclub.com to check out all the other titles that have appeared and get the details of membership there. So like I said, very excited to say this week's guest is Tom Wood. A lot of you will be familiar with Tom's work if you know British photography in particular. Tom Wood was born in 1951 in County Mayo in the west of Ireland. He trained as a conceptual painter at Leicester Polytechnic from 1973 to 1976. Extensive viewing of experimental films led him to photography, in which he is self-taught. Between 1978 and 2003, Tom lived in New Brighton in Merseyside, where much of his most famous and celebrated work was produced. He left Merseyside in 2003 for North Wales, where he still lives today. Tom has published numerous books, including Looking for Love, All Zones Off Peak, Photy Man, Men, Women. His work has been included in many group exhibitions and has been the subject of solo exhibitions at the ICP in New York, in Arles in France, the Multimedia Art Museum in Moscow, MoMA Oxford? Maybe. FOAM in Amsterdam, the Photographer's Gallery London and the National Science and Media Museum in Bradford, amongst others, and is held in the collections of major international museums. Tom has also worked with video on a daily basis since 1988, accumulating hundreds of hours of footage of family life. More recently, he published Women's Market with Stanley Barker, 101 Pictures with RRB Books, and has another book of Irish work soon to be released also by RRB. Tom's first major British show, Men and Women, was at the Photographers Gallery in London in 2012. His first full UK retrospective was at the National Media Museum in Bradford in 2013, and his landscape photographs were exhibited for the first time in 2014. As a kind of abridged bio of Tom, really, it's quite a short one, and that's fine by me, but there are so much more that I could have really added into that. I kind of cobbled that one together from various sources, as is my usual habit, but it doesn't matter, because hopefully you're about to listen to Tom talk about his work. It was a real joy to talk to him, and I'm so glad he did it. It was great to finally get him on. I first contacted him in 2019, as I mentioned, during the course of our conversation, and he very politely explained that he was trying to get on with taking pictures, and there's a lesson there for all of us, I tell you that much, lessening commitment and dedication and single-mindedness, I suppose. But anyway, the point is, he did come on and he did talk to me, and I enjoyed it very much, so I hope you do too. Here's my chat with the fantastic Tom Wood. So you're in North Wales, right?
An hour from Liverpool, yeah.
An hour from Liverpool, right, yeah.
I'm not really remote.
No. Well, more remote than me. I mean, I presume you're in a relatively rural setting.
Yeah, but it's like really close to the motorway, away, and half an hour from Chester, an hour from Manchester, an hour from Liverpool.
Sounds
just
ideal.
On the borders of where it's like real countryside. Up until this point, it's not really, you know.
Yeah,
like gaps between the towns.
Did you? I imagine there's a bit of. Is that a kind of strategic thing for you that you decided? You obviously you had to be within striking distance of your usual kind of hunting grounds in terms of photography.
No, it was purely for my wife. She wanted to carry on working in Liverpool. She ran the antenatal clinic at Liverpool Women's Hospital.
Yeah,
I think I mentioned that before. Where she did her specialised clinics, one of which was for young mothers. So she wanted to carry on working, and this was like, she thought she could commute. It was like an hour. But in the end, it nearly killed her, but she did it for 15 years.
Wow, that is impressive, yeah.
That's not,
yeah, that's
sad. It's sad. Anyway, we did it, you know, and we're here. No, yeah. It was me, I'd done landscape in Ireland, you know, which this new book coming out. I used to escape to North Wales. I had my bus pass, you know, from my bus pictures, all zones off peak, and that would bring me on the train as well, because it was train and bus ferry. And I could get just into Wales on my all zones ticket with my bike. I'd go from Bidston on the Wirral, and then pedal away into North Wales and kind of unwind, get away from Liverpool. And photograph from the bike, you know, foolishly, but that's what I used to do. Cycle all day and come and photograph, of course, on the train going back and so on. After 25 years working in Liverpool, Merseyside, I thought I'd done enough, you know.
When you say you thought you'd done enough, does that mean you've sort of exhausted?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I could have carried on forever, but it would have, would have killed me. It's pretty intense, you know. Really, photographing the way I photograph, and everything. There was so much material around me. I knew I'd be photographing nonstop all the time. Photographing people candidly is, you know, difficult as well. You do that all the time, and then I'd do all the other projects I would do as well with large format cameras and stuff. So I don't know. I was really interested in landscape and. And I missed green. I wanted to go back to Ireland, and my wife wasn't prepared. It was too remote in the west of Ireland. So this was like a kind of compromise, and we were a bit closer to Ireland. I thought I could get across there more often. Yeah, it was just a load of things, you know. My work was just starting to become well-known, you know, more well-known. I was with Thomas Zander in Germany at that point, and I was doing loads of shows. All Zones Off Peak had just come out, and The People Book just come out. I was traveling all over Europe. It was all a bit much for me, really, and being on Merseyside.
Yeah, of course.
And
yeah,
I got really ill with shingles.
Oh, no.
I was ill for about 3 months. The kids were still young, you know, and so Lorna was, my wife was still working full time. I brought up, looked after the kids, you know, so it wasn't great for about 3 months, you know. And after, when I started to feel better, you know, I thought, yes, yeah, I'll move.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you've been busy. When I first invited you to do this, it was 2019, I think, the end of 2019, pre-COVID, of course, before it all went nuts. And you
felt guilty because I don't turn, you know, I'm nice to everybody, really. Don't turn things down normally. So I felt guilty.
No, you were incredibly nice, but you made a very, you know, simple point, which was that you wanted to cut away all the kind of extraneous, unnecessary, kind of time-consuming bullshit that life can throw at you, in order to do the thing that you love to do, which is to take pictures. So I couldn't, you know, your answer couldn't have made more sense to me. But I was wondering, how has that gone? You know, in light of what's been going on, did you manage?
Well, that was kind of similar to what happened in Merseyside at that time. At one point, there were so many projects and books happening. I was working on the Women's Market book with Stanley Barker, which wasn't going well in terms of me and them. And in the end, I had to call in Padraig to help me out, who saved me there. And
Padraig is your sort of long-time collaborator.
Yeah, Padraig Timoney. We'll talk about him later.
We'll talk about him later, yeah.
So he helped me out and took over the kind of layout of the book. They'd done a layout for me which I didn't like, basically. I thought, you know, I'm so busy, I just, you know, I like the book Stanley Barker had done. I thought I'd leave this to them, but it didn't turn out the way I liked it. Just the way it seemed to present the people in the wrong light, which I've always been really concerned about.
Uh-huh. Okay. Talk more about that then.
Talk more about that.
Yeah. And just, you know, kind of in terms of
that's another reason I never wanted to have the internet or, you know, a website or have my images online, because, you know, I feel like a responsibility to the people I photograph, and I never felt I had the right, you know, to use their images. You know, it's okay maybe in a smaller art book, you know, and, you know, a little gallery in Paris or whatever, but now, of course, you know, everything's changed and everything's all over the internet anyway. So
yeah, but you're very concerned to like you say, present the people in a way that you feel is, you know, is honest and respectful to them.
Yeah, I've got a responsibility, you know, to, as they say, to the subject, because I like the people. Yeah? And I went to that market, every Great Homer Street market, every Saturday morning for, I think, about 15 years.
Yeah.
Photograph, you know, on the bus on the way there, at the ferry, on the ferry. I'd be, you know, already half hype, kind of, you know, on the, you know, ready to go when I got there, because I was already working. And you photograph as you cross the road, go through the churchyard to get to Great Homer Street, and photographing all the way. So I did that, and the women put up with me all those years. You know,
I'm
right up close to them, and as you know, eventually got to know people, and you catch people's eye, you speak to some people, got to know the market traders. They were great, you know, taking the piss out of me. And then you end up photographing, you know, some of the weddings of some of their daughters.
Right.
And I liked it because when people were in town, you photograph in the city, people have a mask on, you know, they're not there. Whereas Great Homer Street, the women went just dressed dead normally because it was other women, people they knew, and it was out of town, and it was really natural, and it was a great place to photograph. And going right back to the beginning, you know, I used to collect, when I was a kid, I used to collect postcards, and I used to put them in different albums. You know, I had so many. So I had an album for churches, an album for soldiers, and an album for mothers and daughters and sisters. So that's what you get at the market. It was like all these different, you know, one of the guys there, one of the Irish family traders was saying, like, look, you know, he said, look at them. They've all got the same face. It was like four generations.
Right.
The thing that made it a bit easier was a lot of the women reminded me of my mother. So it was that kind of Irish connection, I think, it kind of helped, you know. There was like a shared, just in the eye contact, a shared kind of understanding.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because obviously you were born in Ireland, and you're about to release a new book of Irish work, which I definitely want to ask you about. But that Irish connection that the Liverpudlians have, I'm assuming was partly why you were sort of so drawn to the place and why you felt sort of in some way connected to it. Is that basically true?
Yeah, but not consciously initially.
No, just subconsciously. I was thinking,
got a job at the art. You know, I was doing all kinds of things. Wanted to carry on doing my own work. I had spent 3-4 years at art school. I'd worked at Butlin's Holiday Camp. Mm. I was back working in the car factory where I worked before I went to art school. And my sister saw an ad for a job at Liverpool Polytechnic as a photographic technician in fine art department. And I applied for that and went along and got interviewed and got the job. So I became the photographic technician. And there was no kind of lecturer in photography. Mm. So I was kind of working as a lecturer on the lowest level of as a technician. I did that for a couple of years.
Enabled you to sort of pay your rent and also pursue your own photography. It was almost a kind of ideal.
I thought I'd have long holidays, you know, and have the time, you know, which I did to an extent. But, you know, getting to know a place, it was fine. We went to a flat agency and got a flat right by, I don't know if you know Liverpool, by Hope Street, by the cathedral, between the cathedrals. In the end, that was right next to the art school. I don't know what happened. In the end, yes, people said maybe it's not the best place to live for other reasons. And we went back to the flat agency and he offers us this flat on the promenade in New Brighton. Mm. We went across to see it. We'd never been there before. And there it is, right on the river, you know, virtually on the same level as the River Mersey. And it was quite high up, this flat, and you could see the river, see Liverpool across the way. It seemed great, you know. The air seemed a bit fresher, maybe.
Right.
I didn't know New Brighton was there, you know, and all that kind of material. I didn't know the Chelsea Reach nightclub was there. And I was just married, you know. I just married Lorna. I didn't even know her. We'd married without really knowing each other. Hitched down from Scotland, you know.
It's incredible how, you know, a whole kind of lifetime can change on these totally random sort of chances. But if it wasn't for the fact that, you know, like you say, it was chance that you ended up in New Brighton and that's where you were photographing. Like, you know, it was just this fact that you ended up, like, an estate agent showed you a flat there. And that was the next 25 years of your photographic life.
Yeah.
Photographing in that area.
So thank you, Marion, my sister, who sadly, you know, died at 50.
Oh, God, I'm sorry to hear that.
Of breast cancer, just loveliest girl. When we did this mother, I actually did a mother, daughter, sister, but whoever would have dreamt that? There I am as a kid, you know, collecting postcards. And I actually do my own book and included some of those postcards. And we had a picture of Marion and dedicated the book to her.
Oh, that's beautiful. So the Women's Market book, that did, obviously, that is available through Stanley Barker. And you obviously, you ended up with something that you were happy with. And
yeah. I like it a lot as a book. I mean, it's very difficult to photograph the same thing over and over again, week after week, and with tiny nuances. And why do you do that?
Yeah. Why do you do it?
That's a good question. I've got here, we're not doing the thing. I'll show it to you. This is one of my journals I was telling you about where I write things in. Because I've got a lousy memory for quotes. And there's pages and pages of a physicist in there called Richard Feynman.
Mm-hmm. I know Richard
Feynman,
yeah. So much of
what he said, I used to use in my teaching material. It's like just absolutely, you know, spot on. He talked about accumulating evidence, you know, without ever, you know, publishing. And Feynman said he would not understand the real physics of a system until he had painstakingly isolated and calculated all the forces.
Right. And that's almost your approach to the photography.
Yeah. So many things he said, like invisible attractions and repulsions that give matter its visible qualities. There's like hundreds of things he said, which I wrote down, you know, I don't know, 30 years ago, whatever. This was taken from, there was like a BBC Two documentary about him.
Mm.
40 years ago, maybe, right? And it was so long ago, you could send in an A3 folded up envelope, stamped, addressed, and they sent you the whole transcript of the two programs.
Oh, wow. That's very cool.
And I made notes from that.
Yeah. So you've been sort of fairly obsessively writing, you know, in a kind of a journal, or you've been making notes forever, right? What sort of compels you to do that? Is that part of...
Can I just... You know, there's one more quote here about that. He says, "Nature uses only the longest threads to weave her patterns. So each small piece of her fabric reveals the organization of the entire tapestry."
Oh, that reminds me of a sort of kind of fractal geometry type of an analogy.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. I could just read it forever. He talks about rhythms of spaces. Yeah. If what am I dealing with the women's market, if not rhythms of spaces?
Such a sort of creative way of approaching his discipline. Amazing guy.
And the Joyce one, he talks about, this is James Joyce, yeah? Individual moments, right? This is what I started reading when we lost it. Individual moments are often undistinguished, but then the evidence accumulates. So I'm going there week after week after week, year after year, right? So the evidence accumulates along with evidence of distinguished moments. So occasionally I get something. Small particulars begin to define when they appeared only to multiply. Traits become reiterative. A central energy seems to evoke rather than compile them. So all these, you know, these kind of things, this is what I thought, yeah, this is it. This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm after. Where I,
yeah.
So I get it from that kind of stuff and from poetry, you know.
You should do a book called The Evidence Accumulates, Tom. There you go. That would be one of your next book title.
Remember I told you about the guy from Nevermind the Buzzcocks, Sean Hughes.
Sean Hughes, yeah, the comedian who unfortunately died. Yeah, I should just mention briefly to the listeners that we had a little sort of phone conversation, which you know, ended up being quite extensive. But yeah, you mentioned that Sean Hughes, the comedian, who some people of a certain age will definitely remember. He was interested in your work. What were you gonna say?
I mean, obviously he's Irish, and I didn't know who he was when he emailed me. He said he wanted to buy some books. I think he was on tour and he saw the work of retrospective at Bradford, the National Media Museum. And I said, sure, you know, I'll send you some. He said, no, I'll come and get them. Next time I'm on tour. So 6 months later, he said, right, we're traveling through Wales. We're going to come see you. So he came with his manager, and he bought half a dozen books. And I was telling him things like this kind of stuff, you know, and telling him some of the stories for the pictures. And he was saying, you should write this down. Anyway, but it wasn't that great that he came to the house and he kind of got the work. He's such a lovely bloke. Yeah,
he was a nice man. And he bought, what, 9 books or something?
6 books.
6 books, yeah. He obviously had good taste, but also had a bit of a, unfortunately, was undone by the booze, like a lot of people, and that's what killed him.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Can I just say that about he had good taste. It's kind of lucky for me. So a lot of my work, not all of it, but a lot of it is accessible. You know, it relates in a level where people who don't really know about art or photography could still kind of relate to it and like it. And hopefully, you know, all that other photographic stuff, the way it works, that's a kind of, you know. There's that element of, you know, me being a photographer's photographer, but it's kind of accessible.
People see themselves in the work, recognize themselves, or people like themselves. So there is, like you say, there's something about it that is fantastically, accessible, I suppose is the right word.
Yeah, maybe it touches people, you know, maybe it's... they get a jolt of recognition when they see the pictures.
Let's talk about Ireland a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't get around to sort of saying what you've been shooting basically in the last year or two. Because I'm assuming your enthusiasm for making pictures is not diminished.
No. I mean, Ireland is a really good example of the way the whole thing works. I went there first when I was still a painter on my foundation course. And they'd given me a camera right at the end of the course because my name was Wood. They did it alphabetically. So I'd already got into Leicester Polytechnic to do fine art painting. And I got given this camera, and I guess I never thought about it at the time, but everything I shot on that first roll of film, which was done on a Rollycord cameras, a twin lens looked down into it, medium format, and every picture I made was a portrait. And one was an old elderly lady outside a post office. And I said, can I take a picture of you? And she just kind of held her coat open. It's in the women book. And a few little details. And there's like the Queen's crown is above her head by sheer chance, because she was outside a post office. It looks like it's on her head. When I got back and developed the films, and I showed them to Len McComb, who was the head of the course there. He was a really good artist, good teacher. And Len said, hasn't she got a great face? And that was like really important to me, just him saying that.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah.
And then I had a load of money because I used to work in the car factory. And because I was a mature student, I went to art school when I was about 21. Mm. I was being paid a fortune working on nights. And I was in in Oxford the next day, and there was a camera, a chemist that sold, you know, those days chemists sold cameras and film. And there was a secondhand Rollycord camera for £30 there. So I bought it just on the strength of that one picture. And wow. Next door, there was an antiquarian bookshop, and it had a review copy of August Sander, photographer extraordinaire, in the window. Wow. Brand new, yeah? For £2.50. And I bought that because I thought, wow, these look just like the postcards I collect, but they're better. So that was an important day for me.
So what a day. Yeah, you bought your Rollycord and you bought the August Sander book. That's in right. The same, what an incredible and then, day. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I wanted a smaller camera. I bought this little 35mm, again, I had money, 35mm rangefinder camera called an Olympus ECR. So it's electronic. It was like you could focus it with rangefinder. It's dead easy to focus it at a very limited range of focusing. You could just fire it, you know. And so I bought that. And that Christmas I went to Ireland. You know, every year I'd go back to Ireland with my dad. I think we moved to England when I was about 3 or 4. My mum had already run away to England and, you know, left him. That's another story. And so we'd go back every year and work on the farm all summer. Sometimes he'd leave me there, you know. And so to go back with him that winter, and I had a camera in my hand, we never had a camera in the house, you know. So it never occurred to me to take a picture before. But I found everything that was there I wanted to photograph. I photographed like crazy. I was just really shy. The stuff in the pubs was really good in those days. And my mother's family, my Uncle Josie had never married any. This old lady who'd looked after the family, she was still there. She was like all in black. Molly was her name. Yeah, she'd buy the fire. You know, it's like a peat fire, turf fire. And there's kind of smoke in the room and, you know, 25-watt light bulb, you know. And I had my camera, you know, I was too shy to take pictures.
I think people would be surprised to hear that you're shy, given, you know, still your work. But is that really true? Because, you know, how do you negotiate those scenarios that you've been so famous for having photographed in the, you know, the Chelsea Reach nightclub and all that kind of stuff? Yeah. Surely you've got to have...
people who know me, you can ask them.
No, I believe you.
In the beginning, when I used to ask people's permission, you know, I had the roller coaster go up and say, I'm doing this project, you know, about mothers and daughters, say, yeah, can I take your picture? But I'd have to build myself up to want to do it, you know, and I'd go red in the face. And people can kind of tell that stuff, you know. But at the same time, I knew I wanted a good picture, not just a stupid picture. So when I used to go to the charity shop when I was still at school, I'd get off the bus and there's this charity shop. It's a great place to go in and unwind. And I'd buy all kinds of magazines and cut pictures out, stick them on the bedroom wall. And the whole bedroom wall was covered in pictures. It's like an L-shaped room, so every wall. And the ceiling as well. And never occurred to me that was interesting in photography, but, you know, it was like rock stars, girls, and pictures from, you know, to fill spaces that cut out of Picture Post, which is Bill Brandt, which I had by my bed, you know, by my eye level was in my bed. You know, that one of the, there's an image of some children running down. It's hard to describe. There's a big chimney with smoke coming out of it, but it's not real smoke. He's burnt it in, and it's a kind of railway going. It says Catch Point.
Okay.
It's like there's a smoke going across, and the railway line going down, and the kids running this way. I think they've got like a little homemade sword in their hand out of wood. That's what I imagined, anyway. So I had this image. You know, I never thought I was interested in photography,
but you clearly were fascinated by imagery. And
yeah,
if you had those magazines,
in the charity shop they also had always had family albums, and I would sometimes buy family albums just because I liked one picture in there. And for some reason, they had thousands of postcards. I remember they had a column of going, it's the ceiling, postcards, penny each. And once a week, I'd go flick through a few thousand, you know, and buy maybe 10. And eventually, this built up, these postcards. And I would want a really good, most images are dull, you know, they're okay, they're dead, most of them. And you're just looking for one that's alive for some reason. So I knew when I made pictures myself, I wanted them to be alive.
So you sort of learned the ropes in a way by just kind of deciding, you know, or learning to differentiate between what you consider to be a good image and not from the collecting these postcards.
Yeah, I can remember, I'll be walking home. Every time I walk home, it's like you cross the main road down the side street, two side streets to get to my home. I'll be looking at the postcards I went, thinking, oh, why did I buy this one? It's not good enough. You know?
Right, right. Wasted a penny.
Hey, yeah.
You wasted a penny.
And then when I was at home, I'd be thinking, you know, when I had different albums, you know, what should I put this one with? And I'd be moving the pictures around, see which picture went with which picture.
Okay. So you're sort of learning some sequencing as well there without even realizing what that even is.
Absolutely. Amazing.
Amazing.
So yeah, people wouldn't say what like one of your questions for later was like about what photographers influenced you. I would, I never thought about it at the time, but it's clearly found photographs.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and even, I mean, later on, I mean, you did a project at the psychiatric hospital in Merseyside. Rainhill, yeah, and you photographed there. But then even there, found photographs came into the picture because you discovered some images that taken by one of the doctors there.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, so that was
like I never had any money to photograph ever normally, but there was this institution called the Documentary Photography Archive in Manchester University, and they gave small commissions, and this was like a commission to do with care in the community. They were closing, you know, all the big hospitals down, mental hospitals down, moving people out into the community. So it was a 6-week commission, and I spent 2 years doing it. It took me 6 weeks just to get to know the people and get permissions, you know. Anyway, I photographed there for 2 years, and one day Steider will bring it out as a book. You know, the DPA work is supposed to be a book, a box with three books in. One is the institution, the mental hospital institution. The other one is the shipyard institution, which was closing down as well, Camelaird Shipyard. And the third little book in that box, that archive box, which Gerhard Steidel will bring out this December, like he says he will, found photographs. You know, and when they were literally knocking the place down, I went back and there were these skips, and there was all this stuff, and I found some of the albums which had like portraits. There'd be like contact prints, you know, from big negatives when people came to the hospital in like 1910, 1920. Now, a couple of the people I photographed and got to know, older men, I actually got permission to take some of those pictures, but they covered up all the kind of text, you know, so I had a picture of them when they were young. So that you can actually see that in the book when you see the Rainhill book.
Wonderful.
But even stronger and earlier than those pictures were these ones I found. They're just really powerful. They're about 6 by 8 inches, contact prints mounted on card. And they're just so, they're kind of, and of course it was in days before drugs, you know, and the kind of expressions and everything was like something I could never capture, you know. And I used a big camera. I used my 10-8 camera in Rainhill, you know, for portraits some of the time.
Well, you've always mixed and matched your formats and your cameras. Like you have no qualms about really experimenting with everything imaginable. That's always been part of your process. You've done quite a lot of panoramic type stuff. Is that you just have a sort of curiosity about exploring different formats? Do you?
Yeah, I never thought about that consciously either. But going right back to the beginning, that when I was waiting for that first roll of film to be developed at Oxford Polytechnic. They had a big, I was in the photography department, right? Not fine art department. And there's a big letter, camera magazine from Switzerland, printed in gravure. The whole issue was on Joseph Sudek.
Okay, Sudek,
And I stole it. And again, this isn't me. I knew nothing, you know, I collected pictures of people, but I knew nothing about, you know, art photography. And it's like, you could open up some pages folded out and they were panoramas of obscure landscapes. that Sad Amazing. Landscape came later out, came out as a book, Sad Landscape, and there's these wonderful still lives in his house, done on a 10 by 12 inch camera. Just all of it just knocked me out. And where does that come from? I just recognized Sudek immediately.
Yeah. Well, you really went in, you know, at the top when it came to sort of stumbling upon influences. You know, you had the August Sander book,
yep.
you know, as the first thing, and then the Sudek. I mean, you weren't messing about there. So everything kind of played
and then,
in.
But there was nowhere to see photography books in those days. So when I had my end of year show on the foundation course, it was all paintings, you know, but I had a table with a few pictures on that I'd made. And this photographer came in called Paddy Summerfield.
Mm-hmm.
And he was friends with Tony Ray Jones. And Paddy had had stuff published in Creative Camera. And he said, these are really good, Tom. You should take more pictures. Come around and see me. I'll show you some books. I went
That's
around
fantastic.
To see him. He's really, really enthusiastic, Paddy was. And he picked me up. He lived like the other side of Oxford, North Oxford. We were like the car factory end, South Oxford. And he spent a whole day with me. I remember he'd just bought Band on the Run, and he kind of took the arm off so the record would keep playing over and over again. And he just talked about photography the whole day.
Amazing.
He had this magazine called Album. A British magazine, lived only 13 issues or something, yeah? And he lent me all of those to look at.
So he really...
Paddy was a big influence on me.
Yeah, he really... He must have obviously saw a great deal of potential in your work, and
it was only two rolls of film,
right,
and that's the other thing we mentioned was on that second roll of film, when I bought the camera, and I went out on that second roll of film up the Cowley Center, just up the road from where I lived, near the factory. These two girls were stood waiting for their boyfriends had gone in the toilet. They had fish and chips in their hand. I said, can I take a picture? So that's the image, Entleman. And I thought, wow, you know what, a great picture. Photography is dead easy.
Yeah. Well, exactly. You must have been given that impression, I suppose it is. But well, let's talk about that. But I love that. In fact, I'm going to use that image as the one on the website when your podcast goes out, if that's all right with you. I love that image. What do you remember of that moment then? Did you chat with them? Were they?
I mean, the boys came out in a minute, you know, but obviously they were just.
Oh, so you had,
I lived in the area. I think I recognized them by sight, or they might recognize me by sight, but they didn't seem worried that I had a camera. I mean, I was young. I was a good-looking lad myself. I was probably red in the face when I asked them, as I normally was in those days. But, you know, all the things that are great about it, the way the sign is broken at the top, you know, and the way it's framed. The first print I did of it when I was on the foundation course, I'd cropped the sides, but it's much better. Even though it's wonky, it looks better square.
The square,
yeah.
But you must have thought, well, yeah, what's the big deal then? You know, like this, you recognised it was a great picture, obviously, for a start, which I suppose more or less anyone would.
Very soon I realised it's a lot easier to look through, you know, 3,000 postcards to find 10 great ones than it is to go out and make 10 great pictures.
Definitely. But to get something like that on your second roll of film, I guess that's...
Well, even the first one, I mean, you know, it's a joke, but, you know, the old lady opening her coat, it's in the women book.
Right. That was the first role. Yeah. So what do we think then? Is photography easy?
Well, I mentioned to you Chuck Close, you know, a great photorealist painter who took great 5-4 portraits himself. And he cut them into squares, didn't he? And would paint each square meticulously. So he said photography is, you know, it's pretty easy to get pretty good pretty fast. But to, you know, make a great body of work that's your work, no one else's, it's like, you know, pushing a rock, a boulder up a hill. So I'd go along with that as well.
Yeah, well, that's where the time element comes in, the sort of long-term commitment to what you do, right? And going back and over, which is what you've already done, always done. And you've always worked, you know, had, like, I think you said it yourself, 10 projects on the go at once.
It's only now I'm past it. You know, it's like my way of keeping it as creative as I could, to keep that many balls in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing is cut and dried, and there's a kind of chaos, you know. So you're kind of working in this chaos, and that's where I felt the good stuff would come, which when I wasn't self-conscious at all.
Mm.
So, yeah. You know, I was reading a thing about, I still, whenever I read I actually just finished a book last night about Shostakovich and Benjamin Britten. That surprised me. I never thought I'd like Benjamin Britten's work. And I always loved Shostakovich. So I didn't realize how close they were. That was really interesting. And
there's they were friends, were they?
Yeah. When they were both getting quite ill, sadly. But no, maybe 10 years, you know.
Interesting.
And some mutual influences. So I actually got one quote from that, which I sent to my son, Kieran, who used about me in the press release with Irish Work to do with using lots of different formats and approaches. And that came from the Britain, from that, you know, that I read recently. So I still make notes in pencil. I read Neil Young's autobiography. Neil's interesting because he still tries and cares. You know, he really cares. You know, goes out on a limb sometimes. You know, I'm right with him on all his concerns about the environment. Maybe that's one reason I don't drive a car myself. Mm. But it's all down to the songwriting. There's one little bit he wrote about, you know, how do you get a great song? And he says, you know, you can't kind of look for it. I'll have to get a quote out of my book. It's like five journals on. Something to do with rabbits and holes, you know? Waiting for the rabbit, your net's never going to come out of the hole. Kind of. And there was another bit was to do with playing and that, you know, some people go into the studio and play for 2 years to make an album. And of course, he does a lot of his stuff spontaneously. That said, some of the stuff, earlier stuff he did where he really worked on the arrangements worked well as well. The idea, you know, I used to find if I only went out to photograph every so often, I was kind of self-conscious about it and it was like a big deal. And really early on, I learned if I went out with my camera, you know, even if it's in a bag, it's no good. You've got to have it in your hand, no lens cap, nothing, ready to shoot, you know, at an approximate distance. And that if I photograph all the time, it's easy. There's no self-consciousness. So you're just doing it. And then that's where the James Joyce thing comes in. Can I read it?
Yeah, please do. I love these. You can give me as many of these as you want. I'm going to throw a few of your own quotes back at you.
Some of my quotes are like amalgamations of stuff I've read so many times.
Yeah.
So this bit about Joyce, this is right at the beginning where from the Richard Ellman biography of Joyce, which is just great. And he's talking about the incessant joining of event and composition. So the events of his life are becoming artistic sources, even as they command his present attention.
Mm.
He shapes again the experiences that shaped him. In turn, the process of reshaping experience becomes a part of his life. Participation in two continual simultaneous processes. Right. So say that to my two kids, because I brought the kids up and Lorna worked. I did a little bit of part-time teaching and I'd try and do my own work at home and they'd be trying to get your attention. You know, so I found if I videoed the kids, I was paying attention to them and they just kind of got on and played and we interacted and stuff. So I'd shoot video every day as well as photographing when I was in the house and I couldn't go out, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And, a little anecdote about Martin Parr, who moved to New Brighton after I'd been there a few years and he lived on the prom as well and our wives got on well. And we're both really funny compared to us. He would always, you know, he didn't believe in this thing of photographing, you know, the way I do. And he came to see me here recently during lockdown. And we went up on the hills, right onto the top, which you can walk along the kind of the crest of the above the Vale of Clwyd, really beautiful. And of course, I've got the camera and I'm photographing from the car all the way. And we get up there and there's this family having this picnic. There's most wonderful clouds and a wonderful view behind them and everything, you know. So I immediately, if the camera's not taking the pictures, and Martin's got no camera, he kind of gets out his phone, you know. And he said he bought a small camera just recently, you know, because of that. There you go.
So as far as Martin goes, Martin Parr, I know you both obviously known each other forever, but there seems to be a sort of mutual respect there as far as the work goes. Has Martin been a supporter of your work?
Yeah, always. I met him really early on, 1981 or something. There was a show in Upper Mill. There was a little gallery there put together by Charlie Meacham. And that's where I met Martin. He was living in the west of Ireland, or in the middle of Ireland, and I was living in Merseyside. And he wanted to move to Merseyside, and I said, I want to move to Ireland. So we talked about swapping houses.
Right.
In the end, we didn't do that, and he ended up living on a promenade near us, on the river, you know. So I've known him a long time, and he's always generous to me. In New Brighton, he was using he kind of made this choice then to change from black and white to colour consciously, yeah? And there was me coming out of art school, you know, I didn't see why, you know. Anyway, he had a Ploughbell 6-7 camera, and for that camera you couldn't get different lenses. So he had a standard lens one and a wide one, and he was always using the wide. So he offered to lend me the standard lens, Ploughbell, which is just a great camera, kind of folds up in your pocket. You can get kind of almost, almost 5-4 quality handheld. You know, it's amazing.
Yeah, so, yeah. A friend of mine had one of those.
Later, I bought one, and so a lot of those key New Brighton portraits were done on that camera. I mean, before that, I'd been using the Linhof, on a tripod and so on. So it freed me up a lot in terms of portraiture. Mm. Got me closer to the idea of snapshot.
Mm. And then, if you got a book out, obviously he'd buy a book, or he'd buy a couple of them maybe.
Yeah, he was always astute right at the beginning. I mean, when Looking for Love came out in about 1988, he bought 10 copies off me just like that.
Wow,
good discount, And when All Zones Off Beat came out, he bought the dummy book off me, and he bought the whole set of prints.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they were really good prints, because they were in those days. Yeah, prints. You actually scanned the prints, So they were all black and white with my beautiful little 12x9, exhibition prints.
So I mean, that's quite a big chunk of money when you were probably a bit skint at the time.
Yeah, I mean, that was the least money he paid me. And then when it came to Bus Odyssey, which wasn't maybe as powerful or good a set of prints, he paid me a lot more money. And when we went on to Photoman, he came to the house and he looked at the dummy book, and he just put a sticker on everyone. It was about 23 prints, and paid me proper money.
Yeah, yeah. So thousands of pounds.
Yeah, absolutely. So Martin's been good. And just because he was there, and it seemed like he did well, and he kind of raised the stature of all of us with him. Just little things for me. I know he told me when that big show was being done at British Photography at the Barbican by Val Williams, was it? And I wasn't in the show. Martin said he wasn't going to be in the show if I wasn't in the show. And he wanted Graham Smith in as well. But anyway, I got in the show, and she put me next to Martin. So those kind of little details add up over time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's considerable sort of kind of gentle support going on there.
Yeah, and so when I did Photy Man book, I just wanted to give him a credit. I just said something like, to Martin Parr. For being Martin Parr, because we all know he's criticised a lot and so on, but I spend my time defending him, I think. Because on balance, he's been great for British photography. That kind of major show, which made him famous, was The Last Resort.
Mm.
And that was a joint show.
New Brighton. Oh, right.
Yeah. And it was going to be a joint book.
Right.
Do you want that story?
Yeah.
So Martin's living in New Brighton on the promenade. His wife, Susie, and Lorna, my wife, got on pretty well. That was good. And we came to do, he photographed in New Brighton. He moved there just to photograph the place. I lived there already. And he photographed there for maybe 4 years, a long time for Martin to spend on one project. I mean, he traveled a lot, did other stuff. And then we're having a show together called The Last Resort, a joint show. And Martin was planning a joint book. And Corner House at the time, it wasn't Derry Lewis, someone else was dealing with the books, and two curators came to see, both Martin and myself in New Brighton. And they saw me first and everything was great. And they saw Martin, and then for some reason he decided he wanted to do his own book. And what had happened was he sent me to see Peter Turner, this guy from the editor from Creative Camera, who loved my work. He'd written me that great letter to the Photographer's Gallery, like, you know, really early on. And he was doing this American photography show. He seemed overworked, tired. It was very dark in his room. I showed him this whole mixture of prints, which was basically Photoman, you know, black and white and color, different formats and all the rest. All the large format stuff was just crappy work prints. And he just didn't get it, really. And he said he didn't think the work was resolved enough. So I think he told that to Martin. And for that reason, Martin thought, well, I'll just do my own book. So
okay, and the rest is history.
I don't hold it against him. But then he went, you know, into the world, became rich and famous, and became Martin Parr through that book. But it was a joint show. It was a good show.
So in terms of the difference between your two approaches, then he didn't believe in the way that you work, because he's sort of more considered about it. Like, he's going out specifically to photograph in a specific place.
Martin always gave me good, bad, recommendation. He said he loved my portraits, right? He said I should stick to portraiture, you know. I should stick to black and white, you know, things like that. Instead, I used, as you know, I'd use, which is your question, you know, I'm using outdated cine film in black and white because it's really cheap. I buy 200 feet lengths and roll it myself. It costs nothing, so you can work completely freely, but it can be really grainy. I use outdated 35mm color film and cheap film. It's bad color. It's faded, you know. I just accept that.
Yeah. But that begs the question, you know, I know you used to
sort
of go out.
I like photographic quality. I love when I saw the Sudek prints for the first time. And you see them in reproduction, you know, so there they were on a wall. This is like after 30 years. It was like my knees went weak and I almost wanted to wet myself at the same time. And I just wanted to run and grab people and say, look at this. They were just so exquisite as photographic, you know, objects. Tone, everything about it, plus, you know, the way they worked as an image. So, and that was the same experience I got when I first saw Jackson Pollock's paintings, you know, in Peggy Guggenheim's in Venice. I was in this room and there was no one else there, just me and these early Jackson Pollocks, you know. So that kind of art thing and the craft is important as well, you know, but.
Yeah, and you started out painting there. That was your degree at Leicester.
Yeah, I mean, I've been painting for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Used to take pictures at the weekend in the evenings, yeah.
Right. Just to finish, the question that was on my mind was that, you go out, you've got black and white and film in one camera and you've got colour in the other or whatever, but then how do you make that split second decision? Like, isn't it just confusing to decide, well, what am I going to go
of that
for?
Chaos, isn't it?
People, you embrace the chaos.
Often people didn't believe me, and in that recent 101 pictures book, which RRB have published, two images were selected from Women's Market, and in the Women's Market book they're in different places, and Podraig has put them together in this book, and I didn't realize until that moment they were taken out at the same time within a couple of minutes of each other. One's in black and white and one's in colour. There you go.
Right, okay, yeah. So you didn't, just don't embrace it, don't worry.
Colour was really expensive, and then the processing was expensive. So there's always juggling those things. You know, you couldn't afford to shoot 10 rolls of colour every day. Which brings us right way round back to Ireland, when I went back to Ireland, right, that first time with a 35mm camera and just photographed like crazy.
And so, like, the work in Ireland is sort of inevitably quite different, because you're generally, it seems to me, obviously the new book is not out yet, but I'm just looking at some of the Irish pictures on your forthcoming website, which is currently not yet live, but you very kindly gave me access to it. You're in much more rural settings. Basically, you're sort of doing a lot of landscapes there.
Most of the time I was on the farm and no one drove. I mean, remember in the 60s, we didn't get electricity till 1962.
Right.
It was horse and cart.
Yeah.
And no one had a car even in the 70s. So you had a bike, you know, so you kind of stuck on the farm, which was fine. And we never went many places. So I'd be working on the farm maybe, you know, spend a day clearing out the cow shed with my dad, you know, and there's that picture of my dad on top of the dung heap A couple of great images of him up there. So I've got the camera with me while I'm working then as well. So yeah, very different. But all I knew is every time I go back to Ireland and photograph, I get the same emotion, the same excitement. You know, I was taken away from there. I suppose I wanted to leave there, you know. And so to come back was always a big deal to the house.
Because the book is you know, is not just stuff from back in the day. It's 50 years of work, you know, up to closer times. But I heard you say that, you know, it was a kind of bad feeling about Ireland for years, and that even your parents would argue about Ireland. So what can you sort of, is this book an attempt at sort of in a way summarizing your feelings towards the place? Because it sounds like you got, you know, quite complicated sort of relationship with Ireland.
I said about me being shy. So when the guy from Alan Yentop's friend, you know, from Imagine phoned me up, so they were doing this new series of What Do Artists Do All Day, would I be on the program? I said, no, I'm too shy. No way. And he spoke to me for an hour and 15 minutes trying to persuade me, unbelievably, until he told me he saw me talk at the Photographer's Gallery at the Men and Women show. I spoke there for 2 hours. I thought, fuck, if he's listening to me for 2 hours and he still wants to make a film, you know, okay. Yeah. But I was not bad at that talk because there was like 70 people there, all paid £8 each to come in. I got paid nothing for the thing. I was a bit annoyed. And they gave me a glass of wine, you know, before I started. And So I made that program. And in that program, I go into some detail about, you know, the old Catholic Protestant thing and what happened. And at that point, I thought the Irish book was going to be published then by Stidel. So if you're listening, Gerhardt, you don't need to do that one. It's been done now.
I'd love to think he was listening.
So that's on, YouTube in 2 15-minute sections. It's not bad. You know, it was just one guy who did it in the end with a camera and the sound. Mm. And I knew if I was in the West of Ireland, I'd be excited. I'd meet lots of interesting people and things, you know. It would not be, the emphasis wouldn't be on me, you know. So it's not bad. Much as I hate to see myself, you know, but it's okay. So that talks about that. But in the book, to get rid of that whole idea of your own personal feelings and how, you know, there's a picture in there of my granny feeding the hens. And, you know, granny meant a lot to me. You know, my mum ran away. I live with my granny. And, you know, you get up in the morning. Even if we go back there when I'd be like 10 or 11 in the summer, you wake up early in the morning, you go through to granny's bed, you know, and you get in there and she'd talk to you. And so I could never choose that picture for the book. So my way around that was to give the pictures to someone else to choose the pictures for the book.
And that was Patrick?
No, in the beginning it was a great photographer called Peter Finnemore.
Okay. So you sort of you know, take advantage of you know, a sort of objective view of, you know, someone else's take on you know, what should be.
I mean, for a long time it's been Padraig. It's been, you know, my sounding board, you know, the guy I would trust. In the very beginning, I would show, when we did the bus work, I showed to lots of people and would write their initials on the back, you know. So the people like Chris Killip helped me a lot then, you know, even Martin Parr, you know, bringing it to Paris to show it to Christian Cajoul and people like that. And I took what they said, you know, on board. But for a long time, yeah, I just trust myself and Padraig. In terms of what we choose. But I just, for some reason, I had this Welsh body of work as well. And I thought Peter Finnemore would be a great person to look at this work. I liked Peter. And so I thought he'd have a go. So he did a lot of the initial work and a lot of his ideas carried through, even though Padraig kind of almost doubled the size of the book. So he was really important to start with.
Because you talked before also about, you know, how you've got these sort of boxes of pictures marked NR, not required, that, you know, books, but basically images that were rejected, you know, initially. But there's a process of rediscovering pictures which, you know, maybe they end up changing your mind about.
Is, I don't that think they were necessarily rejected. They just weren't used, you know.
That's really not sure required, right?
About them. So I used to write possibles on boxes and reject. So, you know, rejects now, after this long, I tear them up and throw them away. The rest stay as NRs.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly.
And then you end up sometimes rediscovering images that, you know, initially, you know, wouldn't have used.
That is amazing. I mean, we know photography is amazing anyway. If we're listening to this program, we're interested in pictures and how they work, and they don't wear out. If you get a really good picture, it stays alive. And but there are other pictures which you don't recognize, or they don't present themselves to you, or it's like sometimes you have to believe in a picture for it to work. There's a kind of, I don't know what happens. And I've, you know, like shown, say, 10 pictures to 10 people, and they've only picked one of those 10. But I put four of those 10 in a book, which Padre had also selected, you know, separate from me. And some of those people say, oh, I really like that picture, you know, and yet they saw it before and didn't, you know. So it's that recognition is really part of the creative process. So I definitely go into a zone. I'm really annoyed when someone stops me and disturbs me when I'm looking at pictures. I think I mentioned to you, I like music a lot. But listening to classical music on not on CD, it doesn't work on CD. It's always background on CD, no matter what I do. But when I play it on record, it's so alive and real. I find that if it's really good, it stimulates all these different parts of my brain at once. And I go into a kind of different way of thinking, and maybe I make choices I wouldn't otherwise make. So I find that really useful.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. And where do you begin? When you're kind of going through a huge archive of like 50 years worth, I mean, what's the process? Is there some sort of, you know, formula that you employ, or is that embracing the chaos as well?
Partly embracing the chaos. At the moment, when we did men and women books, that came about because when I first met Padraig, someone in Germany said they really liked Looking for Love. It already sold out really quickly, and they wanted to redo it. I said, but when I first did the original dummy, I had all these pictures of these people when they were younger and older, you know, mixed in with the nightclub pictures. And Dowie Lewis, who was at Corner House then, thought it was too much. And he thought we should just concentrate on the, you know, inside what's happening in the club. And that he was right, you know, that made a great book. But I mentioned these other pictures to Padraig, and I only just met him. I met him because when we did All Zones Off Peak, he did a review for Freeze magazine. And of all the reviews that show got, he was the only one who really talked about them as images. See if you can find his review. I think it's online. Mm-hmm. It'll certainly be on that website. And he's, look, he's a fine artist, you know. He's like a year below Damien Hirst at Goldsmiths. And, you know, he was coming at it from that point of view, and he's reading them as images, which is not as documentary. Mm-hmm. Because I'd done Looking for Love, it was like people stamped documentary across my forehead, you know. I use the documentary style, but that wasn't it. So anyway, he came to my house and he saw these other pictures, and he was really enthusiastic. He said, yeah, we should try and do the book you imagined in the beginning, you know? And he started working with me, and he did the working on the layout, and he would take a load of pictures away, and then we started meeting in Liverpool near where he lived. The Merseyside Arts had little offices across the road from where he lived, and we'd go in there and we'd have a little room, you know. And that went on for about a year, and we made this dummy book, which I thought was great. And I brought it everywhere, showed it to everybody, even went to Arles, which is not me, you know, to go somewhere like that. And I couldn't get it published. And eventually I sent it to Thomas Zander, who'd been to visit me in Liverpool on Merseyside, was representing me, and he did the People book. And he said he was jumping up and down, he loved it. And he brought it to the Frankfurt Book Fair. He showed it to a guy called Michael Heiting? Manfred Heiting. Yeah, great collector. And the story is he wanted to show it to Steidl. Everyone was after Steidl, so he jumped in a taxi, same taxi Steidl got in, and showed it to Steidl in the back of a taxi. And Gerhardt agreed to publish it.
Right, right, right.
So can you imagine that? You know, how exciting that was. You know, I went across and met Steidl. And, you know, normally what I'd learned already from printing. You know, I had bad experiences with All Zones Off Peak, and I was really pleased I was out looking for love in Leeds. To be treated the way, with the kind of way you were treated at Stidal, where you met all the other artists who were there being printed as well. You get to stay there. The whole thing was just incredible. And so we're looking at, it was a Saturday morning, and we're on press doing machine proofs, right? With Stidal, the man himself, yeah? And all the black and white and colour mixed together in the layout. And he says, well, we print the whole thing in colour, you know? Can't, you know, print it black and white and it's twice the money. Mm. And he did. We did both, and the colour looked okay, but black and white in tritone looked gorgeous.
Right.
And he said, "Yeah, I agree. You know, but you know, we lose money." So I said, "Okay, I don't want any royalties, you know, can we do it?" And so he just gave me a couple hundred books, which was good. And
okay, he printed it. So you went for the quality.
Yeah. The reason I mentioned that, next time I met Gerhardt, like a year, I already told him I had all these pictures of women. You know, Photo Man was about boy, girl, and time passing, and there was like too many women. So he says, "Where's this women book you promised me?" So I started working with Padraig on a women book.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, Martin Parr came to my house and saw this women book and said, "Where's all the men from the shipyard and football?" And I'm like 10 years behind on everything. Yeah? So that took me like 2 years to look at them, just to dip into that work. And then that became the men book.
Right.
When I met up with Padraig, we both had a sister who lived in Guildford. I know you're checking the time, sorry.
No, I was just plugging my computer in. No, Tom, it's absolutely fine.
By the time he came to do Men, he'd moved to Naples. He had a gallery in Naples, and he was in Naples. So he did the main layout all on his own. All the other books we'd done, we did it, you know, really close together. It was his layout, but it was a lot of input from me. And we spent a day fine-tuning Men. And then when we finished, he presented me with a Men and Women Together book. It was like outtakes from Photo Man. And Stidal said he would print that as well. He was going to do that with the Men and Women. In the end, the photographer's gallery got involved, said it was too much. Let's just, you know, just get the two books done, because you know, they were anxious to get the books ready for the show. And of course, they didn't put any money into the books, and Stidal didn't have the books ready for the show.
Right.
And that's the most popular show they ever had. They had 1,000 people visiting it every day in their history, even more than the Deutsche Börse.
Ten
weeks or something, it's on 7 days a week, 1,000 people every day on average. You know, it's amazing.
I was going to ask you about, there's a sense that in this country, in England, photography has not been taken as seriously as one might have hoped. That show that you're talking about, I might be right in saying that was your first really major UK show.
Yeah.
But, you know, you had a show at the ICP in New York 30 years before that, or 20, you know. So, you know, that's the time lag between, you know, a show in New York and a show in the UK. Do you feel that there's a sense that, you know...
Even then, I was like pleased to have that show. Going back to right at the beginning, there was nowhere you could even buy a photography book. There was no photographer's gallery when I began. So I was, you know, when Looking for Love was finished, I had a show. They gave me the space in the corridor, you know, outside the toilet there. So that's where I first met David Chandler, who's been a good guy to know. But, I wanted all three floors, you know. I mean, all that work is on every kind of format in the world. Instead, we printed everything really small to fit into one room. Mm-hmm. Imagine if I had all three floors, we could have had all the proper scale, you know. Some of the shipyard stuff looks incredible, you know, 5 feet big. Not for the sake of it, because the negs are so good, you know.
They've
been really good. So we did a little bit of that with the retrospective at Bradford. There hasn't been a proper show. I had a great show, two major retrospectives in Moscow, can you believe?
Right, there you go, yeah. But what's the deal with British art institutions in terms of their relationship or their approach or their views on photography? Is it true to say that there's a kind of snobbery about it?
Well, there definitely used to be, yeah, for sure. Mm. I remember the first time I met Lewis Biggs. Lewis Biggs became director of Tate Liverpool. And Lewis was one of the few curators in the art world who kind of got photography. He'd been at the Arnold Fini. He'd met Paul Graham there. And you probably know all this stuff, but...
When he was at Paul's
gallery in London, I think Lewis was working there. Anyway, he recommended Paul to them. And then, so Paul stepped into the art world, out of the photography world. So Lewis, when I first met Lewis, it was in a talk at the Blue Coat Gallery in Liverpool. And he explained that it was the V&A who bought photography and the Tate who bought photography by artists.
Right.
My question was, you know, why don't you buy, you know, Robert Frank? Why don't you buy Joseph Sudek? And of course, the V&A had no money, you know, and no kind of credibility in the art world at all. Anyway, it was like a tiny, you know, Mark Hovis Booth did his best, you know, but he had like a tiny budget. No prestige. And that's the way photography was. It had no prestige at all. So, and then fast forward to the state where now, with someone like Padraig, you know, coming out of that the real art world, kind of gets photography and I love my work and was being read in the right way.
Yeah, yeah.
So things have really changed. And now, you know, we've got photography out the Tate, but, you know, it's still got a lot of catching up to do.
Definitely.
I mean, that time I had my show in New York and I went to the Museum of Modern Art in New York. You know, I was seeing really good photography in there mixed in with, you know, with painting and sculpture and everything. The same in Paris, but that didn't happen in England. It was like banging your head. Yeah, you know, when I finished the bus work, and you know, I'd already shown it to Lee Friedlander, and he liked it a lot.
And there's a nice quote from. I just remember looking at the back of a cover. I guess it was that one where there's a very complimentary quote from Lee Friedlander. I was thinking that's not a bad
as good as endorsement set of pictures as one sees every 5 or 10 years if you're lucky. To meet him was a revelation for me because in England we had no one of his stature. There was no one to go to who had that kind of authority, who kind of got photography and really understood it. Who was that? You know, Bill Brandt, you know, he was just about there when I began, you know, but there was nobody, you know, everyone was like my age. And Chris Killett was slightly older. You know, I went to see Chris once, you know, I was absolutely so scared to go and see him. I had suitcases full of boxes of prints, you know.
Right.
But he, you know, he was really supportive and helped me in the beginning. But, you know, he was struggling himself. He left England because he was $3,000 in debt.
Yeah.
And, you know, he took the job in Harvard, which I thought was a real shame because I didn't want him to go.
No.
My advice was don't take it, you know.
Right, right. He ignored you.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was a shame to sort of lose him.
Yeah.
Well, in more ways than one, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Every level, you know. So he invited me over there because he used to use All Zones Off Peak as his main lecture for the new students.
Oh, right.
I knew the bus worked really well. And he invited me over there to talk and stuff. You know, I was just too shy to go. Like when John Berger invited me out to see him in Tannings or however you pronounce it in France, you know, I didn't go. So I really am shy.
Maybe I was thinking maybe this sort of shyness that comes across when you're approaching people is actually, you know, in a way what sort of diffuses any potential kind of tension, and that, you know, there's something endearing about that if they can see that you're a bit flustered, you know that they're less threatened, I suppose. That's what crossed my mind.
There was one famous to me story, really tough ladies. They're reproduced in a couple of books. One lady's there, she was just great in a bra and she's got like dad tattooed on her arm and glasses on, and she's there with some other people, you know. And there was another lady who had like large breasts and was a bit unsure, you know, why I was taking the picture. And she said, "Don't be so fucking stupid. He's got the face of an angel."
There you go.
You know what I mean? That's just the way I was, you know.
I could tell.
That probably helped me. And, it, you know, yeah, for sure. Why would
people
the women in the market put up with me week after week without telling me to fuck off? And no one did, you know.
Yeah.
And I tried to be, you know, people who look like didn't want to be photographed, I wouldn't photograph them. You can tell to an extent. And other people, you know, I don't know. My whole way of getting around that is just to go week after week after week after week, you know, and just feel you enter. And then in the afternoon, I'd go to the football, which was all men, which was much more aggressive, a whole different feel. But again, do it week after week, year after year. You become another character, you know, in that scenario. And eventually you're kind of invisible.
Yeah. But I've heard you say that you still felt a certain amount of guilt, or, you know, you felt, I don't know why, maybe you can tell me, what was that about? You felt kind of like you're somehow taking something from people, or...
No, maybe.
What's the sense of, you know, feeling kind of guilty of...
I always thought if I was going to be successful and professional and make a living out of this, people could tell, and that would change my relationship with the people I photographed. I thought if I was nobody and just made it out of love, which was true, you know, I'm just crazy about the pace, you know, and what was there. I'm excited by the people, and that's why I made the pictures, and they could tell maybe. But if I was professional, if I sold the images, if whatever, I was successful, that would make me different, and they could tell that. I was saying I was kind of stealing their image, then why would I then have the right, you know, to sell it to advertise?
Right.
Well, I didn't mean I was stealing it.
Yeah.
I feel, it's only recently I heard the story from Marketa Luskakova. I pronounced her surname wrong there, sorry. She said when Gilles Pereira's, you know, in the 70s was photographing in Northern Ireland, and he'd come down to see her and Chris Killip in the west of Ireland. He was always talking about the shooting. And she thought he was talking physically about guns, you know, and he meant taking pictures, you know, shooting. And she couldn't understand that, because in Czechoslovakia, to photograph means to immortalize.
Right. That's actually what the word for photograph is defined. Yeah, that's extraordinary.
And you know that. In those postcards I used to collect, the really good ones, people got that, you know? And those really great pictures are immortal. You know, the people are there. They're alive. They come across at you.
Yeah, and the same with many of yours. The one of the two young women on the bonnet of the car...
Yeah,
I think it's called Not the New Miss Brighton.
Not
Miss New Brighton. Tell me about that one. Tell me about your recollections of taking that.
Just like when I did the Chelsea Reach, you know, people were saying to me, oh, you've got to do it. You know, you've got to do people getting out of the taxi. You've got to do people right. You've got to do it from behind the bar. Do, you know, all this establishing shots and all that kind of stuff. And I never did that. I just did this one thing, people looking at each other. In New Brighton, I wouldn't do the obvious things, like they had a beauty contest every year, not Miss New Brighton. So I had a look. I thought, nah, I'm not doing this. I came outside, and these two girls had been knocked out in the first round. They were sitting on top of this car bonnet, commiserating, having some champagne, you know?
Right.
And I said, can I take a picture? And I definitely went red in the face there.
Yeah.
Especially with the girl on the right of the picture. Yeah.
She's got a very sort of provocative, but in a kind of, I don't know, there's a sort of innocence to it as well. It's a kind
of, it was like the girl on the left was kind of telling her how to pose a bit to start with, but she just really went into it. I just innocently said, can I take a picture?
Yeah.
And great, lucky that I had, you know, I was this whole thing about color as well, you know, because I'd been spent years painting. Why shouldn't I use color apart from it's expensive? You know? So I had, you know, Kodak, what's it called? An early sort of bog standard film, and that film is still prints. Yeah, that hasn't faded. Very Color, it's called.
Very Color, negative
100 ISO. Yeah, and that was in the old, you know, 1960s camera.
Yeah.
And I photographed those two girls with it, and it makes a great print.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And sort of, how many frames of something like that would you normally, you know,
film's
fire
expensive,
off?
Expensive, just a couple.
Yeah.
You
know. Yeah, a couple. Yeah, get it right. I love this thing that you talk about, you know, is that the sort of indivisibility between form and content with photography. I was wanted to ask you about that. You know, you say things like photography is so great as you can't tell where the form starts and the content ends.
Yeah.
Could you?
Yeah, that's not me. That's me quoting.
Oh, you nicked that from someone, right?
That's Joyce again.
But you feel
and
that
that's
way.
That's a kind of whole modernist thing, isn't it, to do with form and content. It's particularly there in photography. You know, Gary Winogrand was one of the photographers who tried to kind of figure out how photographs work. And that time I went to MoMA in New York, I was just so excited to have a show. I had a joint show with Linda McCartney, and sadly she wasn't well, but she was there. And after the show, we had a meal together with Paul and Linda,
a
Zen Japanese restaurant in Times Square.
Mm. There's the Liverpool connection again.
Absolutely. And Paul's mother was a midwife.
Oh, really?
Him and Lorna got on really well. And they used to live in Speke, where Lorna had a young mother's clinic. So Linda really liked my work, and we're going to, yeah. So anyway, next day I go to a museum. I've made an appointment, and I wanted to, I'm in New York, so what do? Go and see sites? No. I spent 3 hours listening to Gary Winogrand videotapes of him giving lectures.
Right.
Sit there making notes, you know?
Yeah.
Hello, Peter Galassi. Well, yeah. So, yeah, Winogrand said some good things. You know, photography is pretty hard to, I find all this other stuff, you know, is another way into explaining it. Mm-mm. These other notes I make, whether it's from physics or from literature.
Right. Yeah. But you don't kind of get too over analytical about it. When I read about photography and people's like critics and people's sort of in the course of just preparing for this, you know, I don't know. It's like I think it's incredible that people are able to articulate photography, you know, in writing. I always refer to that old thing about, you know, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. I think that's been attributed to all sorts of different people, but it's the same with photography, really. In a way, I kind of feel like I don't really get it quite often when I'm reading some of these sorts of analysis, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, because I just want to look at the picture and I want it to have a kind of emotional impact, not an intellectual one.
So I never felt I was intellectual in any way. There was not a lot of culture in the house, you know, that kind of culture when I was growing up. So later on in life, when I learned I could understand classical music, I didn't think I was clever enough to understand it yet. You know, yeah, I knew an awful lot about jazz and rock music and folk music, because our culture when we were growing up in Oxford and Cowley was to see music. And we were really lucky because we had all the universities were put on bands. Polytechnic had really good bands on every week, and there were at least two clubs that had good bands, and I had a mate who drove, and we used to drive to see bands. So we would see like three or four bands every week, and we were really critical.
Wow.
We wanted to see we wanted to see really good bands. We knew what good was, you know. And in those days you could actually be in the room basically with the band, and often you could go backstage. So I did a little bit of drumming, and my mate Ian was a guitarist. And we would go backstage sometimes. I remember I saw Lou Reed at Oxford Poly. I went past him, brushed past him in the corridor saying hi. You know, he kind of said hi to me to get to the drummer, because I'd never seen a drummer drum so hard for somebody for so long. I did the same with Captain Beefheart's drummer. So I really knew about music and did that all through, continued doing that when I went to art school till mid-20s and so on. But when I came to classical music, I never thought I could understand it, but it's exactly the same. So last night I was playing a piece, again on vinyl, of course, by a Czech composer. A violin concerto. What's his name? Martinu. I didn't know this piece. I put it on quite loud, and it absolutely knocked me out every single second. Now, I know when I feel like that, I can look it up on the internet and get a review of it. And I know they're going to say that this is really good. Because every time and other times I think, nah. And I look it up on the internet, and there's nothing there. Mm. It's instinct. You just know it's the real thing and you get it, you know.
And you had that for photography as well from the start. And you seem to have that,
That's interesting in terms of how it's, I look at some pictures in the archive where I'd photograph people I wasn't sure, and it's expensive to shoot medium format. And I would take a 35mm first. You know? 35mm was easier to do and didn't mean as much, and often it wouldn't be as good as the one I did on medium format.
Mm-mm.
But also the one on the medium format had bigger tonal range and more sense of presence. So all that kind of stuff affects you in how you listen to the music. So when I'm listening to music on classical music on CD, it sounds nice, and I don't know enough about the way it's put together to kind of follow it that way. But it's always background, on the record as a reality. Just like seeing something live is always the best thing. And that's maybe that's going back to photography. That's one reason I use different formats, because they, you know, in the west of Ireland, the land is really poor. It rains all the time. There's nothing there to see. So I use this panoramic camera that revolves and records every blade of grass. It's so incredibly detailed, and it has this kind of sense of presence, which you couldn't get off a, you know, small camera for minimal material, you know. But I couldn't use that on a bus, you know.
Right, yeah, exactly. So it's sort of, you're using the tool for the situation that you're in. And you say that, you know, you're not trying to document anything. It's more about deciphering and transforming, I think, is the words that you used. Yeah, can you expand on that a little bit, maybe?
I have to get my notes, you know. No, don't keep the stuff in my head. I read it, I think that's it, yeah, I write it down.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think you should... We should see this. These notebooks. I mean, actually, I think you're probably going to reproduce some of them on the website.
I've done it.
Yeah.
Years ago, you know, 15 years ago, some guy was pestering me to write about my work for this online, which is like early days of online, yeah?
Yeah.
And it's called this, what's it called? This something century.
Okay.
This, I'll let you know, put it in the notes. It's referred to by... what's his name? The guy who did the afterword in the Mother, Daughter, Sister book.
Oh, okay.
English writer, teacher. What's his name? Oh, his name. It's gone out of my head.
But
I could just go and get it there. Anyway, he found it online, and he's writing about me. He was just like doing research online, and he found this something century. And there, to shut the guy up, I eventually, after like 2 years chasing me, I just photographed these books, these notepads, pages, and thinking he'd use a few of them, he used the whole lot.
Wow, yeah.
They're still there.
That's
cool. And so I've took the ones I photographed for him, and I put them on my website for when it happens. And the best stuff on my website, and if you saw that bit, was the resources section.
I did, and it's sort of, well, it's still a work in progress, but there's stuff up there, yeah. And I think it's going to be brilliant when you sort of reproduce some of this stuff. Oh, yeah, It's actually, I think there's more there now, having a look. And what are you going to do with like thousands of hours of video, or is there no necessary?
Thanks for mentioning that. That's really important.
Is it?
That's probably the best thing I've ever done. You know, I've filmed, since the first child. I was always interested in film. When I was at college, because Leicester Poly was the first, you know, up until then, art schools were wonderful places. You go along and you could play music all day, you know, art school. Mm-hmm. That's why so many people in all the bands we loved from the 60s went to art school. Everyone had someone who went to art school. It was a degree course, so you had to choose an academic thing to do, and I chose film studies. And the fellow teaching us, whose name I'd have to let you know who he was, but he was really into underground, what's called avant-garde cinema. Mm. He used to get films for us from the London Film Co-op. Lots of American films, and these were actually 16mm tapes films, and we'd have a projector in the room, so like 8 of us doing it, and we'd do like proper mainstream, you know, European art cinema as well, and Hollywood cinema, you know, in the big cinema in the university, but it was in a room with these little films. So I was really, really, really loved a lot of that stuff, and it still, you know, lives with me. And that's where I first came across Robert Frank, because
right.
we had a couple of Robert Frank films.
Mm.
And you know, the only we wouldn't even know that see those films now if Steidl hadn't, you know, had to be Gerhard Steidl who brought out all those films, you know, which was just great of him on DVD. A lot of that stuff I kind of had in my head and could never see for the rest of my life. A lot of it's, you know, available now, but so underground film, yeah, it really influenced me. And I made some little films on Foundation Course, and
so it's always been there.
Yeah, my girlfriend at the time borrowed some of my footage and used it, and she ended up doing that for her end of year, you know, show. And she's head of, you know, postgraduate studies at university teaching film now.
All right.
And
so, like, I can imagine that, you know, for some people,
film was just, again, really expensive to do. I did little bits, you know, on 8mm. Even in Ireland I did. And then when we had the first child, I'd experimented with video, but it was just such poor quality. And Super VHS had just come out. And I thought, you know, that's like media, you know, getting closer to real film. It wasn't film, but it had a quality about it. So I bought this camera, which cost me £2,200, 1988.
Wow. That's
tapes
tons.
Full size, £10 each.
Wow. You must have been pretty committed then at that kind of...
Yeah.
Like it wasn't just a casual thing.
No, I like moving image. Everything I've done on film is very different from what I've done on still. It's a different kind of freedom. You can zoom right in, you know, you can, it's a different way of working, clearly. And of course, you get sound. So the first child is born. It's wonderful. You're your first child and all the rest. And I was 38 years old then and started videoing. And Lorna would go off to work. I'd get him out of bed, change the nappy, be videoing, you know. We look out the window at the park, I'm videoing the rain on the window. And we do that every day, that whole routine with both children, just everything, all their lives. And then everyone else who comes in touch with them. And luckily, you know, all, I think they turned out normal, nice, balanced lads. All the other family, all the rest of people involved, all kind of played along in this game. So I really would like something to happen with that material.
Yeah. I mean, it seems extraordinary that you wouldn't...
It's about 700 hours, but it was...
700 hours, okay.
Yeah, what's really interesting is, that level of just any kind of... I don't know what the kind of scientists kind of deal with that would be. You know, there is this material of every single day of a child's life. I know people do it academically, but this is done as a piece of art, you know? So when we come to... do the Irish book, Peter Finnemore said, you've shot this video in Arlington, let me send me some video stills. I'm like, I said, that's hundreds of hours, Peter. Anyway, Kieran, my son, ended up going to college and did film, and he makes little films himself. And he ended up working as an assistant, the assistant to Laure Prevost, who later won the Turner Prize. So he's had an interesting life since she won the Turner Prize. And Kieran makes his own work. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. So he did me about 600 video stills for the first Irish book. And I sent them to Peter. And Peter really liked them. And he put six in the book. Later, I was giving a talk in Dublin about the men and women work. And I was projecting some of the Irish images. And I mentioned this. And Padraig was come across from America. He was living in New York then. And he came back in Northern Ireland, visiting his mother, and he came down and he shouted from the gallery how much he liked these video stills. So when he came to work on the book, he said, send me more video stills. So we sent more. So there's about 20 odd, 25 video stills within the Irish book.
Right.
Some
he didn't have
page,
enough stuff to
some are small.
Edit from. Yeah. So it's got like 300 pictures in that book or something.
There's 290 pages.
290 pages. Okay, okay.
Yeah. Some of them are double page spreads and stuff. So I think it's about 220 pictures.
Cool. And like before we kind of go, because I want to do the bonus questions for my members. So, you know, listeners, if you're not a member, you can sign up and then you get more Tom doing his bonus questions, which will be, I know it will be as good as this has been. But you... got a lot of stuff going on. So you've got this Irish book coming out. What else is in the pipeline? If you've got a football book in the pipeline.
Yeah, that's the only problem with having kept so many balls in there at once. Nothing ever got finished. And I think it's been, four books in the last 4 years?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't mention saying, when Padraig and I, he presented me with this Men and Women Together book, which didn't get published by Stidel. And then... an American fashion guy in New York wanted to publish it as a book. And then when the women's market was coming out, Stanley Barker said, no, it would compete with theirs, even though it was only like 500 copies. So he said, okay, I'll do it the next year. And again, next year was COVID and everything, you know, so he wasn't able to do it. So now a guy in Japan, Super Labo.
Super Labo. Yeah.
So he's written to me and said, anything you'd like to publish. So I've sent him that, and he likes it, and he wants to do it. So that's another book. So there was the women's market. There was the little book, which I thought was kind of throwaway. I let this guy Jerome do, Gwyn Ziegel in France, a little book called Termini. Have you seen that?
That's the book of the ferry.
Crossing on the ferry every day and photograph on the ferry. And I was telling you about, that was a strange thing because, you know, I'd walk along the promenade late, you know, in 25 minutes to get to the ferry, just miss the ferry. And some other people hanging around there. You're looking at time again, sorry.
No, I'm looking at my notes. No, don't worry about time. I'm mindful of your time, Tom. My time is, okay. You've got all day as far as I'm concerned. I could talk to you literally for 3 hours, but I'm mindful of your time.
So the ferry, can you imagine, you know, remember going back to, I just got married and, you know, we're living on the River Mersey, you know, I love the Beatles and the Liverpool football team. You know, we're in this place. It was just so exciting. And the ferry was like a commuting ferry. It went every 10 minutes and normal people on it. So you just missed the ferry. So you see two other people missed it and you're hanging around there's a kind of floating bit, you know, it goes up and down with the river and you're waiting in the waiting room there. And you've got vistas of the river and boats going by and photographing. So I've got my camera hand all the time. And, yeah, have I got a right to photograph this person, you know, having a cigarette over there and all that kind of stuff. That's all my way of learning to photograph. So I kind of did portraits mostly for 3 or 4 years. And I have the camera on the tripod. I had a big Linhof camera at that point. And you see the stuff going by. What was that? Yeah, and you think, you know, I really felt I had to learn to use a small camera. So being on the ferry would be one way of doing that. And you're looking at people and they see you and you're there with them in silence, you know, for 10 or 15 minutes. What's happening? Mm. I mean, there's something's happening between the two of you. You know you're there, you know, and I've got a camera. And then I see that same person, you know, 3 weeks later or 3 months later or 3 years later. And I take a picture of them. So that was part of this process, which is this kind of mental thing of where something is transmitted. You know, I talked about, you know, that sense of being stared at. I really kind of believe that, you know, people can sense you're doing it. Even when they haven't seen you, I think they can sense you're doing it.
Yeah. And like we said before, they can also intuit, you know, what your motives are in a way, or at least whether you are, you know, kind of in some way a benign force, you know.
Nothing's being said. So all that is being,
Wonderful.
All that is really interesting. And, you know, we're all interested in other people and how all that works, I don't know. There's lots, you know. Another thing I've been looking at, in the archive, we were pictures of the dogs. We always had dogs.
Oh, dogs, you know? Yeah. Because no wonder you had 10 projects at once, because basically and every sort of aspect of your daily life, you know, was its own sort of distinct project. Yep. So your bus journey, where you're going to somewhere where you're going to photograph, that in itself is a project. And then, you know, your ferry crossing when you're going from, you know, New Brighton to Liverpool and back.
The river is walking alongside the river.
Yeah, it's part of it. So,
but also taking the kids to the park, you know. So I bring the video camera with me sometimes and the still camera. So I'm doing that in the park, and we also bring the dog, of course. So I've got these pictures that maybe not the best picture in the world of the kids, but maybe a good picture of the dog. Right. So I've got these boxes of dog pictures. That's the first dog called Dell. And then we have this wonderful dog called Loppy. That sense of being stared at thing, that idea. And Loppy could tell when Lorne would come home every kind of time, you know, because the traffic from Liverpool was so bad to where we live now. And Loppy would be out at the door 10 minutes before she came in. Now, she'd come in at 5:30 or 6:30 or 7:30, but he wouldn't be there. He would just 10 minutes before she came. No way could he hear the car.
He just knew. Yeah.
I believe that kind of stuff. Yeah. Anyway. And me and Loppy used to communicate. And again, when I speak to the dog 10 times a day, 20 times a day. And when I think, oh, I better take dog for a walk. And he'd be at the door like he knew. She knew. So she's a wonderful dog. Died of rat poison. Cried more about that dog than my mum and dad, you know. We all did. And then we had this character dog called Cocker Spaniel called Muddy, a working cocker. Not as bright as Loppy. Loppy was a real lady, refined. And so I photographed Muddy a lot. I'm on my hands and knees. And it's interesting, dogs are really interested in smell. And smell is one of the kind of sensitive things that we aren't as sensitive to now as we used to be, you know? Mm. You know, it's really important, isn't it, to us as humans? But so, he's really into that. So I'm on my hands and knees photographing him, doing his smelling and lifting his back leg and all this kind of stuff. So I've got millions of pictures of him. So there's a book as well.
Yeah, we might have a dog book at some point.
It'd be a funny one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look forward to it. All right. Well, look, I'm going to draw this to a close. The Irish book is going to be out the 1st of October.
It's being printed on the 24th of this month.
So perfect timing in terms of this podcast. And obviously, I'll put a link so the listeners know where to get it. But it's going to be available from RRB Books in Bristol.
Can I just a little addition here? I couldn't believe it. I mean, Rudy from RRB said he would like to do a football book with me because I photographed at the football, you know, for all those years as well. That's got to be a book. He wants to do, I did a lot of work in the Chelsea region, black and white. In the beginning, colour was so expensive and my pictures were so poor. I went back to black and white. But I look at those now and they're something about those. So that's an easy book.
Yeah.
Stidler has still got to bring out the DPA work, the shipyard and the mental hospital books, which are really 2 years, 3 years work in each of those.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Gerhardt, if you're listening, it'd be great if those could come out.
Gerhardt. Come on, let's do it, man.
This year.
We trust you.
Sadly,
trust you,
I mean, I'm getting older, and so is Gerhard, same age as me, and maybe I've got 10 of my closest friends, 5 of those have died in the last 2 years, all of whom were desperate to see that. So it'd be great to,
no pressure.
To see that
no
out.
Pressure.
But it's great to have, you know, a landscape. You know, people only know me for this kind of people thing, really.
And right, exactly.
They kind
of
know the Chelsea Reach stuff, and they kind of know there's going to be football stuff. So for Rudy to say, you know, he was saying like I do those, but then maybe do the Irish book because it won't make any money. It's so big, you know, and it's abstract. And there he is. He's doing it right now. So I'm knocked out. And then on top of that, there's a special edition with 2 analog darkroom proper prints. And Padre's done this wonderful painting, which will be on a heavy duty stock, which is as a kind of dust cover, which goes in a case. And I'd buy it just for that cover.
Mm. So that's,
if you had the money, that would be the thing to buy. Yeah. The
special edition. Yeah. Yeah.
The
and it's Padre. I don't know. Did we mention it? I don't know if we did, but Padre, his surname is Timoney. So it's Padre Timoney. People can find him. He's, as you say, an artist in his own right. And
really great artist.
A long term collaborator of yours. But
a lot of the reasons people like a lot of my books is down to him, or the way he's put the pictures together. Right. I think he's affected the wider history of photography and the way photographs, you know, possibilities, how they, you know, one small further story. When I was shortlisted for the Thatcher Years show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York back in early 80s. So the other person listed who didn't go into that was Marquetta. And so Susan Kismarek came to see me, and she'd just been to see Graham Smith. I had a long night with Graham, and then Graham drove her down, and there's some stories around that. Anyway, she came, and Graham went away, and she started looking at my work, and she looked at what was basically Photoman, with black and white, color, 35mm, large format, medium format, everything. And she said she didn't feel the work was resolved, that I couldn't mix this kind of work together. And she wrote me a letter, which I put on, have a look at it. I think it's there. I guess I can do that, you know, on the website. Saying just that, you can't do this. And that was in the early 80s, you know. And you know, Photoman now is like considered a classic book of how it's in that list of great photo books and of all time. And that's Podrick, you know. He's got this wonderful eye. Things happen, and we broke a lot of rules out doing those kind of things, you know. Chris Killip helped me with the bus book. And discussing books generally, he was great because he told me about Ed Vanderelsken, Sweet Life.
Oh yeah, did he talk about it when I had him on the podcast? But I love that guy, Ed Vanderelsken. He's a wonderful.
And it's so hard to get hold of that book. I battered old copy, and there he broke all the rules. And he's got really grainy stuff, badly burnt in stuff. You know, talk about not cropping. You know, and he had some color in with the back. You know, and I showed that to Padraig. So that was a big influence on us. So that's great. Chris told me about that.
Yeah.
Go on.
No, I was going to say, and you know, your 101 photos, that was sort of those those were edited by Martin Parr. So again, you sort of...
Well, Martin selected the pictures, but he asked for Padraig to do the layout, yeah.
Right, yeah. So that was a kind of joint effort, but you sort of ceded control in a way.
Yeah, that's the easiest book I've ever done.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've got people you can trust there, I would think.
Yeah. And it was printed by, you know, those guys in Denmark, Narayama, and it's really, really nicely printed. So I hope the Irish book is... If it's the same, I'll be really, really pleased.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be. I look forward to seeing it.
But yeah, Padraig is really key to the work, and how there's two pretty good pictures, but he puts them together in a way often that something's happening in between.
Yeah,
he would do a layout where he uses the studio and lays the pictures out around the floor. He gets up in the morning. In those days, he'd drink coffee and cigarette, and he'd work his sequence, see the whole sequence, the whole pattern. And when he had the Irish book, which he had, you know, Peter Finnemore had done the original, and Padraig had escaped New York from, you know, he wanted to leave anyway, I think, but because of, you know, the virus, he was back in Northern Ireland, his mum's house. I think he's in Ireland, you know, he can look at this Irish work, all this extra stuff I've found. And of course, I carried on photographing for the next 6 years as well.
Right,
so I sent him all this stuff, and he said, yeah, okay, I'll have a go. And he couldn't resolve it. It was so big and complex. And he went to Berlin. And he used Douglas Gordon's studio. He let him use his studio, and he did the same thing there. And he said he wasn't going to go back till he finished this book. So it's a hell of a sequence, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm happy to stop now.
Well, look, we've got to do a bit more as it is, and you know, I want you to be able to get on with your day. But it's been a real honor to have you, to be honest. It was an omission that your voice wasn't you know, added to the podcast, and it's fantastic that now I've rectified that problem. So thank you so much for talking to me, Tom.
One final quote, can I throw in?
Yeah, hit me with it.
Yeah, photography is just great. It's just as exciting, as you can tell, you know, to me now, as it ever was. So Lisette Modell, I've said it so many times, I'll probably say it the wrong way. I'm not trying to prove anything in the pictures I take, but the pictures I take prove something to me. I'm the one that gets the lesson.